The following program, Colombia, where the 1% and multinationals rule with impunity, was sponsored by the Madison Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, on February 25, 2012. The featured speaker, David Newby, is President Emeritus of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO and President of the Wisconsin Fair Trade Coalition. Newby returned recently from a visit to Colombia, set up by the Colombia Support Network. He tells the story of the courageous struggle of the village of Marmato against Grand Colombia Gold, the Canadian mining corporation that plans a massive strip mine that would destroy the village and the livelihood of most of its families. The program was held at the Capitol Lakes Health Center Auditorium in Madison. Now, David Newby.
I'm going to be talking quite informally this morning about a delegation trip to Colombia that was sponsored by the Colombia Support Network in mid-January. And let me say just from the outset, I am not an expert on Colombia. What I would like to do this morning is simply to tell you the story of our delegation visit, which I think does illustrate not only what is happening in Colombia, but relates back to what Bill Greider's themes of the mutation of capitalism and what is happening not only in the United States but in much of the world. Just very, very quick background. Colombia is actually a very wealthy country, but it is populated by mostly poor people, illustrated by the fact that 1% of the population owns 80% of the land. The inequality in Colombia is among the greatest in the world, and it is getting worse because mining and oil companies have been moving into Colombia as they have into other parts of South America, opening huge operations in order to extract newly found metals, minerals, oil, coal, which has, as I say, been relatively recently discovered primarily through new technology and satellite photography. And in Colombia, as opposed to other progressive states in South America, recently progressive, the government is practically giving away mining concessions to multinational corporations, which will not promote any kind of broad economic development that benefits the people of Colombia, but is very advantageous to not only the multinational corporations themselves, but the oligarchy that runs Colombia. So clearly, Colombia, with which, by the way, you may remember, the United States signed a free trade agreement last fall, but Colombia clearly is run by and for the 1%. Late last year, the Colombia Support Network, which is based here in Madison, was invited by groups from the mining town of Marmato in Colombia. I shouldn't read these in Spanish because I don't know Spanish, but the Civic Committee for the Defense of Marmato, the Association of Artisanal Miners of Marmato, which I'll explain in a bit, and then the Organization of Indigenous Peoples of that particular region. They wanted a delegation from the United States and also from Canada to visit Marmato and to report both in the United States and in Canada of what was happening in that town. The members of our delegation included Jack Lawn, who is the president of the Colombia Support Network, works very closely with his wife, Cecilia Zarate, who I think a lot of you know, who is Colombian. Also on our delegation was Bishop Emeritus Thomas Gumbleton from Detroit, Brittany Lambert, who is with the Canadian Council for International Cooperation, and myself. So why Marmato? Marmato is a very small town. The town actually includes about 2,000 people, maybe 10,000 in the surrounding areas. It's in the foothills of the Andes, northwest of Bogota. It's actually built into the side of a mountain called El Burro, which the mountain itself is one of the richest sources of gold in the world. Artisanal mining, which refers basically to not the kind of mines we think of with, you know, a lot of machinery and very mechanized, but family-owned small mine shafts, low-technology hammer-pick operations, family-owned, which actually have been in existence for about 500 years. Gold mining in this particular area began before the Spanish conquest. It was indigenous peoples of the area who started the mining. Spanish moved in, took over, essentially put the indigenous folks to work mining gold in the Marmato area. They died off as a result of European diseases primarily, but also overwork in the mines. So they imported African slaves to do the mining, and as a result, the population of Marmato today is about 50% Afro-Colombian, about 17% indigenous people, and the rest mestizo. Early in the 19th century, Simón Bolívar, the liberator of much of South America, actually mortgaged Marmato and El Burro, the mountain, which contains so much gold, mortgaged it to England in order to finance the War of Independence against Spain. And so Marmato is famous not only in Colombia, but also in Ecuador, Peru, Panama, Venezuela, the area that was liberated. And consequently, in 1982, Marmato was designated by the Colombian government as a national heritage site because of the importance of that particular town to the history of Colombia and surrounding countries. And unfortunately, that national heritage designation was revoked a few years ago, and I think as the story goes on, you will see why. I mentioned earlier that in recent decades, really starting in the 1990s, that as a result of new technology, extractive industries in South America have been growing at a very, very rapid pace, and enormous reserves of coal, oil, metals, minerals have been discovered. And the United States has been very much involved in this process, not only in the process of working with multinational corporations that operate in Colombia and other South American countries, but we know through those WikiLeaks documents that were released to the public, about a year ago now, I think, that back in 1998, Bill Richardson, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Energy, had a meeting with investors in mining corporations, assuring them that the United States would provide military support in Colombia in order to protect their investments. And the United States has been very involved in support of the Colombian government and the Colombian military, which is, I'll diverge for a moment here, but is particularly important because essentially Colombia has been in the midst of a civil war for about 45 years. And on the one side, you've got the government, the military, and right-wing death squads working essentially together. On the other side, you have the FARC, which is a guerrilla movement whose hands are not clean either in terms of civil rights and the murder of civilians. And in the middle, you've got the huge population of Colombia that is the victims of this violence. But the fact that the United States would be guaranteeing to investors that they would be supporting the Colombian military means essentially that they were exonerating the right-wing death squads in their collaboration with the government and with the Colombian military. So it was after multinationals began to move into Colombia and South America in the extractive industries that Marmato's troubles really began. In 2001, the mining laws in Colombia were changed in order to favor large corporations, especially multinationals, and small miners, such as the artisanal miners in Marmato, found themselves at a real advantage because they were essentially had to follow all the same rules as the multinationals, but these were family operations. And at the same time, they were required to get titles or permits to continue their mining, which were very difficult for them to get, even though the multinationals had very little difficulty. In 2007, a Canadian corporation, which was a conglomerate, there's a lot of mergers involved here, but currently called Gran Colombia Gold, in about 2007 began to move into the area of Marmato, and it had negotiated with the Colombian government that in return for the gold that it mined in that area, it would pay actually less than 1% in royalties to the Colombian government. In other words, a pittance of the amounts that they would be taking out, the value they would be taking out. The artisanal miners, by the way, had to pay royalties of 4% since they were not multinationals. So Gran Colombia began to buy land in the area of Marmato and also began to buy out the small miners of the area, buying their mines and the very small milling operations that were associated with those mines. They destroyed the mills so they could no longer operate, and they actually closed the mines that they had bought from the artisanal miners. There were about 400 artisanal mines in the area. Gran Colombia bought about half of them for far, far less than they were actually worth. But as the miners who sold their mines realized within a few couple of years, they simply could not support their families on what they had sold the mines for and began to move back into the area. Now, Colombia does have one very interesting law, and that is that if a mine is not actively being exploited and mined for more than 6 months, then the owner of the mine loses title. And since Gran Colombia had closed these mines, after 6 months, technically and legally, they became open once again to others to start mining. And so these miners, as well as others, began moving back and reopening these mines without title, but with the support of this particular law. In January of 2011, the army moved in order to evict these miners who legally were mining these mine shafts, but they encountered a great deal of resistance and backed off. It was at that time that organizations which had previously been formed became extremely active in Marmato. The Civic Committee for the Defense of Marmato and also the Association of Artisanal Miners. In May of that same year, they organized a general strike against Gran Colombia's other projects in the area, which did not make the corporation or the government very happy. And also, it became known about that time that Gran Colombia's plan was to raise the town, destroy the town of Marmato, and essentially begin to destroy the mountain, El Burro, that contained the gold, and end up with an open pit mine. To, in other words, eradicate that mountain and end up with a huge open pit mine, and totally, obviously, displacing the population in the meantime. They figured this would be about a 20-year project, and they also estimated that there were 10 million ounces of gold in the mountain of El Burro. And I think gold is now selling for what, about $1,700, $1,800 an ounce? So do the mathematics on that. And of course, then they would pay their 1% royalty to the Colombian government. In August of 2011, there was a video put up on YouTube, an interview with the local priest, Father Jose Ranel Restrepo, who stated very clearly that as long as he was alive, that his church would remain in Marmato on the side of the mountain, and there would be no open pit mining in Marmato. 4 days later, he was murdered. There have not been any charges filed in that murder. It is technically listed, I guess, as simply a theft, even though he was shot while he was on his motorcycle from going from one town to another. But obviously, this was a message to the inhabitants of Marmato that resistance was futile, to use an old phrase. The right-wing paramilitary death squads, by the way, have been most active in the mining areas of Colombia, and they often help to displace peasants who are living in the areas in order to open up these areas to the multinational corporations. And so the involvement of death squads in the murder of Father Restrepo is certainly very, very likely. And don't forget that Colombia, for example, is the most dangerous country in the world for union leaders and activists. There are more union leaders killed in Colombia every year than in any other country in the entire world, the country that we signed the free trade agreement with. But it is not only union leaders that are targeted, it's also other people like Father Restrepo. The Civic Committee to Defend Marmato had been reaching out for some time to environmentalists in Colombia, to student groups in the at the university in the larger town fairly nearby of Manizales, and then reached out to the Colombia Support Network late last year in order to try to get greater international publicity, both in the United States and in Colombia, since Gran Colombia Gold is a Canadian corporation, but to get international publicity for what was happening, realizing, and I think quite correctly, that if they could get greater international attention to what was happening, that they had a better chance of winning their struggle, and therefore our delegation visit in January. During that 8-day, very short delegation meeting, we met with many of the local leaders in Marmato, in the area. We made visits to the mining areas, to the mines and to the mills, talking with miners. We met with government officials, not only in Marmato, but also in the provincial capital of Manizales, as well as in Bogota, the capital of Colombia. We also met, incidentally, with high officials and even the president of Gran Colombia Gold, which is a story in itself, which I won't include in my main remarks, but it's maybe we'll get to that a little bit later. We also met with members of a Jesuit think tank in Colombia that has been studying violence in Colombia for many years and documenting it, as well as progressive political leaders in Bogota. The most moving event in my experience there was a meeting that we had towards the end of our visit in Marmato with miners themselves, a huge meeting that was organized essentially around our visit, but had a great many other speakers. The miners themselves, we don't really know how this was organized. But it was fascinating because in the morning you could look out onto the side of the mountain and you would see all sorts of folks in the distance working in the mills that were processing the ore in order to remove the gold. You could see people coming in and out of the small mine shafts that they had been mining for generations. And then shortly after noon, they began to disappear, and gradually they began streaming into the small town of Marmato, into a second floor disco dance club that had been cleared for this meeting. And by early in the afternoon, the entire hall was totally filled. There was standing room only. People were even standing on the stairs leading down to the street. And just seeing these folks congregating in this way was a moving experience in itself. It was a fairly long meeting. It was addressed by the new mayor of Marmato, who expressed his opposition to open pit mining in Marmato. A little bit cautious, but he was certainly on the right side. Much to our surprise, the local police commander also indicated his opposition to open pit mining. The most raucous response was received by a representative of the governor of the province of Caldas, who announced that the governor, fairly recently elected, was completely opposed to open pit mining, not only in Marmato, but throughout Colombia. And she received cheers and applause, a standing ovation. Francisco Ramirez, who is the president of the Miners Union in Colombia, and an extraordinary figure who I had a chance to spend some time with, also spoke to the group and received a very warm welcome. Francisco, by the way, has survived 7 assassination attempts in the last 12 to 15 years. A man, an extraordinary man, courageous man, and leader who is in his mid-40s. and yet has survived these attempts. He doesn't go anyplace without bodyguards, but bodyguards are not always successful in protecting the people that they guard. And in fact, there are other people that we met with that had bodyguards and were wearing bulletproof vests as well. The leader of the indigenous community of Marmato, which has been very active in opposing the open pit mine, spoke. The leader of the miners group, Yamir Amar, who incidentally, just another side thing, his father is actually from Lebanon and emigrated to Marmato early in the century, and now that family has been there for two generations operating an artisanal mine. And then members of our delegation spoke as well. In my brief remarks, I promised that I would do my very best when I returned to the United States in order to initiate a union campaign, both in the United States and in Canada, in support of the people of Marmato and in opposition to the open pit mine. And in fact, I have had some initial discussions with the steel workers and other pro-worker groups that work in the international field to protect unions and union leaders. The miners, when they first entered the hall, you could see that they were very skeptical. I mean, they had given up a half a day's work in order to come to this meeting, but they weren't really sure what they were going to hear. And yet, as the afternoon progressed, you could see that as there were expressions of opposition to this open pit mine and to the destruction, therefore, of not only the town of Marmato, but their very way of life that had been in existence for 500 years, turned to hope and at the end, I think, to very, very strong determination. And it was clear to me and others in our delegation that these folks are going to continue to struggle no matter what the cost, including perhaps their own lives, in order to protect their town, their families, their jobs, and their way of life. Our responsibility, I think, is to support these people simply as a small step in order to try to stop the rape of the planet's resources by multinational corporations, simply for the benefit of the 1%. In Colombia, that means the oligarchy, the army, rich stockholders of the multinational corporations, and CEOs who, as in most large corporations, are receiving absolutely astronomical salaries and stock options. So this is a very small part of what is happening not only in Colombia but throughout South America and, as I think we know, throughout the world. But it is, I think, incumbent upon us to do everything we can in order to express our solidarity and support with these folks who are really on the front line in trying to make this a better world. So that's my story. Thank you.
Now we hear questions and comments from the discussion group and responses from David Newby.
Are there any avenues to the Obama administration on this subject?
Sure. First of all, as he promised here in Madison during the primary campaign, he could order a complete review of the free trade agreements that the United States has signed. He even promised in writing that there would be a renegotiation of NAFTA, the first of the huge free trade agreements. By the way, the Colombian free trade agreement was negotiated while George Bush was still president and was approved by President Bush in 2007, but it was clear that there was not congressional support for passing that free trade agreement that got linked to one that was also negotiated about the same time with Korea and another one with Panama. But shortly after becoming president, President Obama revived the discussions around the Colombia Free Trade Agreement as well as the others. There were some changes that were made to the agreement, particularly in the area of the number of murders of union leaders and other civil rights and human rights leaders in Colombia. And Colombia did sign a side agreement which was supposed to change the situation. And last year, actually, there was a reduction of the number of assassinations of union leaders from a little over 50 to about 40. So we're making progress. But yes, I mean, the United States has immense influence in that country, and obviously has immense control over American multinational corporations, which are also involved in many of these new extractive and mining operations. It doesn't have control over Gran Colombia in Marmato because that's a Colombian corporation. The United States is working very closely with the Colombian military. There's evidence that in the past, probably in the present, that many of the officers of the Army were trained at the School of the Americas in techniques of repression and torture and assassination, as many of you, I think, are aware. So the hands of the American government, and therefore our hands, are bloody, and not only in Colombia, but in other countries in South America as well as other parts of the world.
I think it's important in looking at Colombia to know that the present violence is actually not something, it's not a recent phenomena, but it's something that came as an outgrowth of a period in the late 40s and early 50s known simply as La Violencia, when there was fighting between the country's two principal political parties, and I don't know how many thousands were killed, but essentially what's going on today is basically an outgrowth of all that.
Right. I did mention that in passing, and it's absolutely tragic, and it's almost impossible to know where to start in terms of resolving this conflict. While there is the growth of a progressive political party, the Polo Democratic Party, it has a minority in the parliament in Colombia. But as I mentioned, there's no group in Colombia who is innocent in this conflict. You wish that you could say, okay, there's, you know, the guerrillas out in the hills, they are fighting for the people. Well, they certainly are closer to the people than any other group that's trying to make a big difference. But they too, I mean, they're heavily involved in the drug trade in order to finance their operations. And they have actually been responsible for the murder of, well, one person just a couple of weeks ago, living in the town of San Jose de Apartado, which is the sister city of Dane County, and which the other part of our delegation visited in January. And these are brutal murders. I thought beheadings were something that happened in the Middle East in some of the conflicts there. That's not true. Apparently that's becoming the assassination method of preference, because about 10 years ago, a child was beheaded in this main square in San Jose. This was by the right-wing death squads in order to send the population a message. And the person who was murdered last week in San Jose was, I believe, also beheaded. Absolutely brutal, the kind of violence that is almost impossible to imagine.
Two things come to mind. One, what we did, the American Indians and Manifest Destiny and Monroe Doctrine, bringing it south. It seems the parallels are amazingly striking, if you will. And to bring it into the current situation, the mining bill is opposed by a lot of Indian tribes up north and so forth. That's going through the Wisconsin legislature right now.
Which will be a little bit bigger than the open pit mine in Marmato, but not much, by the way.
Okay.
Four miles long, I believe.
So, yeah, right. So your comments on those broader themes.
Yeah. Well, my hunch is that part of this is being driven by the demand for raw materials from China and India, as well as simply the discovery of these reserves that had not been known or only partially known in previous decades. But that means that there is an awful lot of money to be made by large corporations like Gran Colombia Gold and other multinational mining corporations. And that is what I suspect is feeding this particular move into South America, making it essentially the extraction part of the world where we're going to be mining for many, many decades in order to supply raw materials to expanding economies such as India and China. Gold is not necessary for anything really, or maybe very little in terms of productive capacity, but obviously has immense value. And so gold is certainly sought not only in Colombia, which probably has has the largest gold reserves, documented gold reserves in the entire world, but also huge reserves of coal and oil and other minerals. But it's tied into a world economy. It's tied into world demand.
I'd like to bring this into a global perspective. Just looking at Syria and what the UN and the Arab countries are doing relative to Syria to bring them into line, is there anything that the UN can do? Is there any organization of South American states that might put some pressure on Colombia, or are they all pretty much in the same boat?
To my knowledge, there are no major organizations, multinational governmental organizations that are working in Colombia. There are a lot of human rights organizations and union organizations that are trying to make a difference.
Question about what we can do here as a citizen in Wisconsin.
Well, it's hard to know. Again, because of the complexity of the conflict in that country, as well as, what can we do in this one situation for Marmato. What I think we will be doing in the union movement through the steelworkers, possibly the AFL-CIO, some other unions, in both the United States and Canada, is simply an email campaign to the president of Gran Colombia Gold, as well as the president of Colombia and other officials in Colombia itself. They are very sensitive to international attention. And so as weak a gesture as it seems, we think that a campaign of this sort actually can make a difference. And it's going to take us another month or two to get this campaign in place, but I'd be very happy to share the email, which I think you can probably send out through your own list. As with these things, it seems like we're doing so little, but these campaigns can have an effect. And so sharing that that email, which hopefully you could send out, would be something that we can do. There may also be something done through our sister city relationship with San Jose. I've not had conversations with the Columbia Support Network about that, but that does give us a direct link to Columbia in which we can also perhaps help provide some aid.
Fred Johnson, I'm with DMI Board. What participation has there been from neighboring countries taking the initiative of being more organized down there and working together? And Columbia is sort of like the pariah, in my opinion. Has there been any participation from the neighboring countries? I mean, they have probably have similar concerns, even though they may not have the amount of resources.
Right. And you're right. I mean, it's ironic that Colombia is located geographically between Venezuela to its north and Ecuador to its south, two of the countries that have become very progressive in the last within the last decade. I was briefly in Ecuador last year, and so had a means of, again, I was there for a very short time, but to see what's happening in Ecuador in terms of the development of the infrastructure of that country and redistribution of wealth within, just 3 or 4 years of the change of government. Venezuela is far, far more controversial in terms of its policies, but also in terms of redistribution of wealth, has done amazing things for the population of Venezuela. Colombia is the only country, I believe, in South America, someone correct me on this, which never went through any kind of land reform. And that is one of the factors cited for the reason that the oligarchy has been able to maintain such tight control over the country and its resources. Well, I think it would be very difficult for any other country to intervene physically. There is some traffic across the border in southern Colombia and Ecuador, but that is primarily by gangs that are involved in the drug trade. But otherwise, there's, to the best of my knowledge, there is not any direct interchange there.
Sir? Yeah, I'm just wondering, as far as support from indigenous people from outside of Colombia, it was some of the joining countries, are they getting support from indigenous people that have a better say in their affairs in their own countries?
Well, the indigenous groups in Colombia are supposed to have a say, and they are to be consulted in any project of this sort. There are some technicalities in the law and in the United Nations declarations, which the indigenous groups can also appeal to, which, again, require the consultation of any company that wants to move into indigenous or formerly indigenous lands for this kind of development. The same problem was encountered in Ecuador with regard to the development oil reserves in the northern part of Ecuador. And there, part of the controversy now is just what does this multinational corporation, Gran Colombia Gold, have to go through in order to get permission to continue with this project. They say they've gone through the process. But in talking with indigenous leaders, it appears that there was one meeting in Manizales, which is about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours from Marmato, primarily on one-lane dirt roads that are primarily potholes, which we traveled over a number of times. And I can attest to the fact that they are not comfortable travel. But there was one meeting in Manizales, the capital of the province, which was not well publicized. And Gran Colombia maintains that that was the consultation process. That is being appealed, and they are now saying that they will set up a process in the area so that the indigenous representatives and peoples can have their say on this project. As a result of organization of the groups that I mentioned in Marmato, which is fairly unusual, Gran Colombia has begun to try to clean up its act. And they tell a great story about being very sensitive to the needs of the local people, the fact that they will be giving them jobs, and helping to relocate them to a new town at the bottom of the mountain, which has already been partially constructed. But when you ask them, and I said, look, I don't know a whole lot about mining, but I do know a little bit about open pit strip mining. And the folks who are using picks in order to mine gold in these artisanal mines, I doubt whether they have the training to operate these huge, absolutely gigantic machines that are used in open pit mining, some of which are produced and built in Wisconsin. And they said, well, you know, there are other jobs, there are trucking jobs and so forth, and they've talked about training people in how to do metalworking and making jewelry out of gold, for example. But it's very clear that that if they are actually successful in taking control of this area and beginning the construction of this open pit mine, that a large proportion of the people who are now making not a magnificent living, but they're able to support their families as they have for generations off of these very small mines. Many of them will be unemployed, and Marmato is one of the relatively few places in Colombia that has just about full employment. The rest of I think the unemployment rate in the rest of the country is somewhere between 15-20%. This will also add to the displaced population, and out of a population of about 45 million people, there are well over 5 million people in Colombia who are considered displaced, and primarily as a result of these kinds of extractive industry projects.
David, this is the thing that bothers me, because it seems as though, I'm Gene Farley, and it seems to me as though the corporate power, which we're fighting in this country, is the thing that the whole world has to fight. Because we've given dominance, and the World Trade Organization absolutely reinforces that. So I hope that our fight against corporate power here has some significance as we try to struggle against corporate power all over the world, and maybe we can affect the World Trade Organization. That's really a question, in case it's not.
No, I absolutely agree, and you're right. I mean, this is all part of one much larger problem, and the one that Bill Greider was talking about when he spoke to the Madison Institute. Corporate power is not being checked or regulated these days. It's growing, and more parts of the world and more parts of the economy are coming under the control of large corporations and increasingly multinational corporations. So the struggle against those corporations, which is becoming more and more difficult as they become more and more powerful, is all part of one struggle. And by the way, the next big free trade agreement is going to be one called the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement, which negotiations have already begun for. It involves currently about 12 to 15 countries, and may include more, primarily in South Asia. And Joe, you may want to speak about this, but when exactly that free trade agreement will be completed is uncertain. To my dismay, and I'm sure yours, the negotiations for this agreement are even more secret than they have been under previous administrations. And the only people allowed in the negotiations are government officials and approximately 200 certified corporate representatives who have interests in various industries in these countries. So, you know, corporations have a seat at the table while we're sitting at this table. And their table exercises a great deal more power, unfortunately, than our table here, even though we are on the side of truth and justice, and they're raping the planet.
We can always say we have the better songs, David.
Yeah, that's right.
Just a little added, and we have somebody
Thank
here.
You.
India has been quite alarmed at the way in which, in the last couple of months, the U.S. has sort of mentioned China kind of as an enemy, and the notion that we need to move our troops to be available for whatever we're going to do in the Pacific. So there's been a kind of a backlash in India about the way in which the U.S. has sort of suggested the new arena for the economics is going to involve Australia, New Zealand, deal with China, and there's a little bit of a backlash even in terms of the way in which India has dealt with Iran. India said it is going to ignore the taboo on buying oil from Iran. India says we need the oil, and so we'll simply undercut the other part of the world. So it's another shift in this very complicated dynamic. But here we have another question.
Actually, I have a comment and then a question. My name is Fran Bicknell. The comment is, can we have an email campaign to the Obama administration about the secrecy? But my question is, or just maybe a comment.
I'm sure, by the way, that, you know, once things begin to get going, there will be a major campaign against that free trade.
I just wondered if they had discussed at all the impact of this open pit mining on the water, and I think about the water in Appalachia and the streams that have been decimated. Was there any talk of that?
Yes, and there are regulations that presumably Gran Colombia has to fulfill in terms of environmental protection. The main concern is with water quality, and this open pit mine will use enormous amounts of water. We met in Marmato with the main mining engineer in charge of this project. And there is a one of the largest rivers in, maybe the largest river in Colombia, the Cauca, is sort of at the bottom of the series of hills, mountains in the foothills of the Andes. And he was rattling off figures saying, oh, the amount of water that we use will be negligible, and
but
don't worry. Don't worry about
it.
They
knocked down trees and everything.
The
watershed.
Sure. And there, I don't think there's any question that the groundwater sources will be contaminated. There's also a real concern about biodiversity, that this area of Colombia, and I don't know exactly how this is measured, but the figure I've seen is that this area includes about 14% of the world's biodiversity. And so if you eliminate this mountain and the surrounding areas through this mining project, then obviously you're destroying, you know, major resources in terms of biodiversity as well. Air quality, I'm sure, would be affected as well. But again, the Colombian government is not well known for its strict enforcement of multinationals following environmental laws or any other laws, so it's very possible that, you know, they'll be able to get around that hurdle too. Their environmental statement, I think, is supposed to be published within the next 2 or 3 months.
My name's Jim Kellerman. David, this is really depressing. So when I look at a topic rationally and get depressed about it, the last thing I grasp for is hope. So I would like you to tell us some hope. If indeed you have hope.
Well, in Marmato, I think there is hope, and it's because of the amazing kind of organizing that's been going on in Marmato and reaching out to other groups. I mentioned environmental groups. There's a very active student group at the university in Manizales with some extraordinary students that accompanied us for a number of days on our trip, and who I'm in the process of getting connected to the Student Labor Action Coalition, as well as the Students Against Sweatshops groups here on the campus. And they're very interested in forming relationships there across borders. So there are some things happening. And as I mentioned, this corporation, as most multinationals, are sensitive to publicity. And in the case of Gran Colombia, they're concerned about, particularly about publicity in Canada, but also in the United States. And I mentioned working with the steel workers in terms of this campaign to aid the miners in Marmato. And the steel workers have taken on as a major project working with mining organizations, unions of miners in other countries, primarily in Mexico so far, but they're branching out. And the reality, some people tell me, is that if the publicity we can generate on this one particular project could drive down the value of Gran Colombia stock on the Toronto Stock Exchange by a couple, 3 points, it might well not be worth their proceeding with this project. So we do have some leverage. And again, because the people of Marmato have so amazingly organized themselves and formed alliances with other groups, and because there is still time to mount an international campaign, I think it's possible that this project can be stopped. Now, it's just one project. But at the same time, you know, if you're successful in one place, that gives people elsewhere hope as well, and also provides something of a model in terms of organizing against corporate power. So, yeah, it's depressing, but the determination of these folks is absolutely amazing. And in both Marmato and in our sister city, San Jose, people openly say that they realize that, you know, their activity could cost them their lives. But they're willing to take that risk because of what it means to their families and to future generations. And that's hard for us, I think, to imagine and internalize, to say, yeah, I'm going to get involved in this and risk my life or the life of my family in order to make a difference. You know, we, for the most part, we don't face that here yet.
There's a lot going on in South America to watch. I mean, this is going on, like in Ecuador, they're going through a terrible time. That northern part, which is right next to Colombia, was just ruined by the oil companies. But the new president, or I forget, he's been there a couple of years, a few years now, he's trying to make regulations and keep people, keep corporations out, and there's a lot of turmoil going on in tiny little Ecuador, and Bolivia being the most, probably the smallest, where the indigenous peoples actually won the election,
right.
And the extreme of the corporate takeover was when the corporations tried to sell water to people.
Right.
And they just stepped right in and they won that battle. So that they, but there are things happening and it's bubbling up all over. And so I think there's some hope from some of the successes like Bolivia or Ecuador is right in the midst of it.
Very good points. But you should have saved them for the very end of our conversation so we could leave here, you know, in a much more hopeful mood.
Well, so whether it's shopping malls built in Turkey or gold mines in Colombia, most all of these corporations depend on pension funds and 401ks for their capital. Would you support limiting pension funds to only invest in government bonds or something? Because everyone wants the highest return that they can. And if a money manager doesn't get that highest return, he's out of a job. So don't you think that everyone here who's living on pensions is somewhat responsible for not being content with maybe 3 or 4% rather than 8 to 10%?
It is an interesting question, and one that I can't really answer. It's, I mean, part of the problem is simply that the bond market is so depressed that there's practically no return.
Well, and there you have it. That's the problem. Hmm? There you have it. That's the problem. We all want a return. And the money, you know, the corporates, the oligarchs, they're just getting us all a return that we demand.
That's true. But there has to be much more reorganization of the economy to make that possible. The problem is the private pension system and 401ks. You know, what we have to deal with is in the is the entire pension system rather than how pension monies are invested, I think. Obviously, there's no reason why we couldn't have a national pension plan. An expanded Social Security that was not financed by investments in the markets.
When the word pension came up, you hit my button. The problem here, which it seems almost nobody understands, pensions should not be based primarily on investments. The best pension system until we've begun in the last two decades to lose it, is Social Security. This should not be an investment program. It is pay-as-you-go social insurance. The current working population supports a smaller retired population. That can work. And that doesn't demand high returns from stock markets and so on.
Did you get any insight when you were down there with any one of the officials that you spoke to about the drug problem in Colombia, how serious that is, whether the efforts to combat it are having any success? Because, of course, the main justification for the U.S. for intervening and providing military assistance, one of the main justifications is supposedly to combat drugs, because
the drug trade was mentioned in passing in terms of basically a funding source both for the right-wing death squads and for the FARC guerrillas. I don't remember who I asked the question of, but I said, well, you know, what would happen if drugs were legalized? And they said, basically, the death squads and the FARC guerrillas would disappear. So I guess, you know, we're talking about how do you end the conflict in Colombia. Probably the easiest and fastest way to end the conflict in Colombia is to legalize drugs. It had certainly not occurred to me that legalizing drugs and regulating them and controlling them has effects far beyond simply the incarceration rate in the United States or other related problems, including what happens to people who take them.
This illustrates the extent to which one thing interacts with another in these problems. The U.S. may be declining in many ways, but the influence is still enormous. If we could get a progressive government which would help things move in the right direction in terms of foreign and domestic policy, that would be the most important thing we could achieve.
You don't mean the right direction, you mean the correct direction.
Correct. Right versus correct.
And I absolutely agree. And even though we may not have the world hegemony that we used to, we're still the key and have obviously enormous influence around the world in every aspect of economic and political life.
So, we thank you very much for giving us the information on how bad it is in Colombia, and it should scare us to fight corporations and look for greater equality in
Thanks for that summary, Connie. Thanks to all of you. It's always fun and interesting and lively to be with you, so thank you.
The foregoing program was sponsored by the Madison Institute. Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The web address of the Columbia Support Network is www.columbiasupport.net. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute or of members of its board of directors.